It's Friday, and you are listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. And since it is Friday, as we head into the weekend, we are bringing you our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our state this past week. Our panelists, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, and James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday.
Happy Hello. Friday.
Well, what everyone seems to be talking about is the coronavirus or COVID-19. So let's get updated on where we are with this. Rebecca, let's start with you, just kind of like a overreaching perspective.
So the numbers, everybody's watching the numbers. Do we have any confirmed cases in Idaho yet? And that's confirmed cases. No, we do not. As of this morning, there have been 27 people tested, including 2 people from Oregon. None of those tests so far have come back positive. Now, I think they run the tests like once a day. So this afternoon, that could change. Mm-hmm. It's been changing on a daily basis. But so far, we have not had a single person test positive in Idaho.
And they are monitoring, what, up to 9 people now, I believe?
They're actually monitoring 36. Oh, or 36 have been monitored. 27 are no longer monitored. So I think 36 is the current number. So
how many have been monitored?
So these virus, the symptoms of the virus are somewhat similar to the symptoms of the flu and other illnesses. And so that's why these people are being monitored, and then they're falling off when it turns out that they actually, don't have COVID-19.
And then, Kevin, we just learned yesterday about the Boise State students who are quarantining, right?
Right. They're in 14 days of self-isolation. They're 4 international students that have recently arrived at Boise State. Boise State is emphasizing that the students are showing no symptoms of coronavirus, but they're being placed in self-isolation out of an abundance of caution. And I think that feels like kind of the watchword that we're hearing from the education sphere, but also from the political sphere, this precautionary tone, this abundance of concern. I mean, at the same time, trying to say that, this isn't a crisis, but we're trying to get out ahead of it and take precautionary steps.
And we should say that those Boise State students were tested or evaluated at SeaTac in Seattle, Rebecca?
Right. That's correct.
So, yeah, and they actually cleared that health screening. But because they're from South Korea, and that's an area where this coronavirus is widespread, they're just in an abundance of caution. Mm-hmm. Taking this step.
And then, so Kevin, then from an educational standpoint, some school districts are doing some things, right?
We had a couple of closures in North Idaho earlier this week. The Troy and Genesee school districts closed on Monday. Those are two fairly rural school districts near Moscow. You've also had the State Department of Education issue guidelines for schools as to how to address or get out ahead of a potential outbreak. Again, I think a lot of this is precautionary.
And then what's going on with the legislature when it comes to coronavirus?
Yeah, just this morning you had the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee dedicate $2 million in emergency supplemental funding to tackle anything that might happen with the response to the coronavirus. And then we also got a release from the governor's office, who said the state is also guaranteed at least $4.6 million in federal money. If I remember correctly, at the JFAC hearing, they said that $2 million may be refunded through some federal dollars as well. So that's kind of what we're looking at from the legislature's perspective.
And we do know that the governor has done a couple of news conferences about this, and then the state has put a website together so people can look on that and get updated information as well.
Yep. And if you just go to the Department of Health and Welfare webpage, there is a link right at the top of the page. And so you can Google Department of Health and Welfare and click on that, and it'll take you right to the coronavirus sort of tally and all the latest updates from the state.
And there is other news to get to. So let's switch gears here. And Kevin, this morning, the Senate State Affairs Committee took up the transgender athletes bill. Before we get to that, can you just, I know you and Jimmy have both been covering this, but kind of give us an overview of this bill in case people may not have been paying attention.
This is the bill, and there are several bills that have surfaced this session regarding transgender rights, but this is the bill that would ban transgender girls and women from participating in girls and women's athletics. This is not an issue that's come up in terms of any kind of an appeal of athletes' eligibility. Under the current state policy, a transgender girl or woman can participate in girls and women's sports after a year of hormone treatment, of hormone therapy. This bill would overturn that in essence and would ban transgender girls and women. Senate State Affairs took up the bill for about 2 hours today. They took some public testimony. By my account, they had 19 people who testified, 12 against, 7 in favor. Ultimately, the committee took no action. The hearing's going to continue on Monday, and I suspect that there's a good chance that there will be a vote in committee on Monday. This has already passed the House on pretty much a party-line vote. Now it goes to Senate State Affairs, a committee made up largely of Senate leadership, both Republican and Democrat.
Yeah, and something that should be mentioned here is that this bill is one of 19, by my count, at least, bills that have been introduced across the country that are relating to banning trans women in athletics. You do have some states right now that do ban all transgender athletes. Texas comes to mind, for instance. But far and away, most states do allow transgender athletes at high school level, maybe with some kind of requirements like either the hormone therapy requirement that Kevin outlined that's Idaho's policy, or some actually do force these high school kids to undergo gender reassignment surgery.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, and we should note from a collegiate level, Jimmy, that the NCAA already has certain rules and regulations in place, correct?
Yeah, and you have Representative Barbara Ehart, who's the sponsor of this bill, say that it's a permissive policy, basically letting colleges decide whether or not they want to take that step. But that's not what this is. The NCAA gave me a statement saying that, you know, this could harm transgender athletes. We have this inclusive policy that allows them to participate in these athletic opportunities.
And that's not the only dispute about the details of this legislation and the legal aspects of this bill. I thought Friday's hearing really focused in on a lot of the mechanics of how this bill would work should it become law, and the question of whether the bill as written would require a student to undergo a pretty invasive internal and external examination in the event of a dispute. Supporters are saying that that's not what the bill says or would do, that it would be optional. Opponents, including the Attorney General's office, which did an opinion on this last week, said that, you know, the wording is such that, you know, when you're talking about you shall have this three-step process, which includes an internal and external examination, that that's mandatory, that's a requirement, that that's not an optional situation at all. So you had a lot of debate within the committee and a lot of testimony on Friday morning that really focused in on the legal aspect of it. I mean, it was an emotional debate, as we've seen in the House, but this one felt very, very technical in a lot of respects.
And it does seem that young athletes are really paying close attention. I mean, if you wanted to get a bunch of junior high girls interested in politics, I'll tell you what, based on my kids' teams, when we go to their sports and do the carpools, it's a topic of discussion. Mm-hmm. They are alarmed and they are trying to figure out what's going on and what it means for their careers. So there is a lot of, I think kids are watching this in a way that they maybe wouldn't be watching other legislation involving athletics or schools just because of the subject matter.
You had a high school senior from Timberline, I believe, testified against the bill this morning. You also had a Boise State student who is a transgender woman who talked about her experiences in high school and debated against it, testified against the bill, saying, look, I would not have wanted to have been in a boy's locker room when I was in high school, when I was transitioning.
Yeah, you also did have, I couldn't tell if she was still attending Kellogg High School, but you had a young woman who had wrestled at Kellogg High School, who testified in favor of the bill, saying that she doesn't want to get hurt by what she called biological males participating in whatever sport it might be that she chose.
And her mother, who's a champion powerlifter, also debating.
Correct.
Testifying in favor of the bill.
Yeah.
And a lot of schools are actually moving. I know some schools in the Boise area actually have things like co-ed wrestling teams.
Right.
And so, you know, where you're dividing students based on athletic prowess and you know, weight class and things like that, as opposed to by gender.
Which is actually the result of one of these studies that was brought up by Representative Ehart, where the study is advocating for creating this algorithm to kind of plug in things like height, weight, testosterone levels, everything, doing away with men's and women's or boys and girls categories of sport, and then having everyone compete against each other who have similar physical abilities. But that was not actually brought up by Representative Ehart or Senator Mary Sousa, who also sponsors the bill, whereas they just outlined how in that study, the authors who I've spoken with, you know, said that testosterone does have an influence and may at some levels influence physical prowess or any kind of advantage that people who are assigned the male gender at birth might have.
And we should note, Jimmy, that there is another bill in the legislature. Get us updated on this birth certificate bill.
Right. So you had Representative Julianne Young's bill pass out of the House, that which would ban transgender people in general, regardless if they were male or female, from changing the gender marker on their birth certificate, which was a subject of a lawsuit with a federal court ruling 2 years ago saying this is unconstitutional. The state of Idaho used to just have a blanket ban on transgender people being able to do this. And they said you cannot, this is completely discriminatory and unconstitutional. But that bill would implement a similar policy where basically no one could change their birth certificate except for under certain circumstances. But it says that specifically, you know, you can't change the gender unless that person might be intersex, which allows them some more time to eventually figure out how they're developing physically, and then they can add a gender on that. Anyway, so that has passed out of the House. That's awaiting a Senate committee hearing. But this week, the Health and Welfare Committees in both the House and Senate deleted the state rule that allows transgender people to change their birth certificates, which was exactly what was put in after that court order. And you had, you know, state officials saying, look, we're still going to have to comply with this court order. If you delete this rule, then we don't have any kind of
procedure. Well, then we don't comply.
No, they said that they would still do it. It's just that, like, they said, we will not have a process in place or a standard process in place by which to do this. And it was a party line vote in the House and a 5-4 vote in the Senate. You also, I should say, have another bill from Senator Fred Martin, who's the chair of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, that was introduced, and it would require anyone under 18 who wants to change the gender marker on their birth certificates, they would, in addition to their parents' permission, have to get a note from a doctor saying that, yes, this is what their gender is.
And Kevin, quickly getting back to the transgender athlete bill, so that will go back to the Senate State Affairs Committee Monday.
It's still before Senate State Affairs. They adjourned the hearing this morning to begin their floor session, which you know, they actually ran over and took some extra testimony. There are still additional speakers who want to testify. So I think they'll just reopen the hearing Monday morning, take more testimony. I would say there's probably a good chance that the committee will vote on it Monday.
Our panelists today, Kevin Richer with Idaho Ed News, Rebecca Boone with Associated Press, and James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. And if there isn't enough weird, unbelievable news going on these days, there was a case in Idaho that has garnered national and international attention because, honestly, you could not make this story up. Rebecca, the latest on Lori Velo Daybell, and I guess also, in case you're living under a rock, just a quick synopsis of this.
Okay. So Lori Velo Daybell is a woman whose children, two kids, 7-year-old JJ, 17-year-old Tylee, she has other kids, but they are older, went missing in September. Tylee went missing first. JJ went missing a couple weeks later. And by missing, we mean that wasn't the last time they were seen by anyone outside.
Anywhere.
Right. So she did not report them missing. Some extended family members actually called. They'd been trying to get a hold of JJ, and they're like, why can't we reach our grandchild? And they finally called police and asked them to do a welfare check. And that's when police realized these kids were gone. They started investigating. They realized that there was separate investigations already going on. So they lived in Rexburg, separate investigations already going on in Arizona, where Lori's estranged husband, Charles Ballow, had been shot and killed by her brother, Alex Cox, in what Alex said was self-defense. Meanwhile, Alex died of unknown causes at this point in December. And Lori, after her husband died a couple months, married a guy named Chad Daybell, also from Eastern Idaho.
We should note, only 5 days after Chad's wife mysteriously died.
I think it was actually 2 weeks.
I thought it was like 5 days. Well,
no, but
you know what?
Close.
It's a short amount of time.
It was shortly thereafter.
Quick turnaround. So Chad Daybell's wife, Tammy, who was a school librarian, well-loved and apparently seemed pretty healthy, died in what the family said was, or what Chad said was, in her sleep, that she'd gone to bed with a bad cough and that he woke up and she had passed in the night. And so it was written in the obituary as natural causes. She was buried fairly quickly. The family declined an autopsy. 2 weeks later, Chad marries Lori. So there's these three deaths, these two missing kids, and this sort of sudden and unexpected marriage.
And then Chad and Lori go off to Kauai together.
They took off to Kauai. Police have since exhumed Tammy Daybell's body. Last I checked, those reports, the autopsy toxicology reports, weren't yet available. If they have been returned since, they haven't been released. But I imagine they're still waiting. So anyway, Chad and Lori go to Hawaii. The kids have never stepped foot on Hawaii, and since the time that they've gone missing, police or the courts in Eastern Idaho say, Lori, you got to bring your kids and show them in Idaho by a certain date, or else, you know, you're going to be in trouble. She misses the deadline, so she has since been charged with felony child abandonment. She was arrested in Hawaii yesterday. She was flown, extradited to Idaho. She is now in Rexburg, and there will be a hearing today at 2 o'clock. So it'll be basically her first court appearance on these charges. They won't go over a ton of the evidence. They'll kind of read the charges against her, get things lined up, you know, future court dates and things like that. And but hopefully they're getting closer to answers.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, meanwhile, the FBI is asking for help.
Right.
Right? So if you went to Yellowstone on September 8th, 2019, and you took some pictures, the FBI wants to see them if they have any people in them or silver F-150 pickups, right? Because they are looking. That was the day that Tylee Ryan, Lori's daughter, was last seen alive. So they know that she went into Yellowstone. They have some web camera or entrance camera evidence that they went into Yellowstone together. They know that there are some family snapshots that they were able to find when they searched the properties and computers and whatnot. So they know they were all in Yellowstone together. They're trying to figure out, I think, if Tylee came out.
Mm-hmm. And some of these pictures show Lori, Tylee, JJ, and then Lori's brother.
Brother, Alex Cox, who was still living, obviously, and with them at the time. So the FBI is saying, look, if you were in Yellowstone that day and you have pictures that show crowds or, you know, maybe a vehicle that matches Alex Cox's vehicle, or especially if you can recognize these people, you can upload them to an FBI website. And that is, I believe, FBI.gov/Rexburg. And you can just go there, you can upload your photos, and they are searching for clues. So they're hoping that will turn something up.
It is truly an unbelievable case. And all of us have been journalists for a very long time. I honestly, and we've covered some crazy stuff. This really goes beyond what I think anyone could have imagined, because it's so layered.
Right. It is really complex. It's a very tangled case. It's hard to keep track of. Yeah. It seems to keep growing. I will say, you know, the first case that I ever really covered for AP was the Elizabeth Smart case, which is another one that people thought, no, she's long gone. She's dead, you know. And then she was found. And that was a case, too, that would seem, you know, stranger than fiction. It's always worth holding out hope, I think. But we just don't know. Things aren't looking good. Rexburg police have said they are gravely concerned for the children's safety.
I want to move on and talk about some other things going on in the legislature. So Jimmy, abortion rights, they have been taking center stage in the legislature. What is going on with that?
Yeah, a couple of days ago, you had Representative Brian Zollinger present this bill that would basically make it so no public money, whether it's state, city, county, within Idaho, goes toward a medical provider that also provides abortions. So even if you're going to, say, Planned Parenthood for an STI check or some other kind of maybe women's health checkup,
just
whatever
a well
it might
woman
be.
Check.
Exactly. If you are on Medicaid and you go there, then that clinic could not accept it because they provide abortions, even though it's not from that money. Planned Parenthood says that it keeps separate track of these monies, whether it's like Medicaid or other funds that come in, and none of that Medicaid money goes toward abortions. Under federal law, there are only three cases where public money can be used for abortion, and that's if the life of the woman is in danger, if the baby is conceived through incest or rape. And that is federal law, and this would not stop that. Anyway, so you had this on the House floor, and it really kind of highlighted a schism within the Idaho Republican Party, because you have some who are absolutist and want nothing to do with what they see as, you know, further cementing legal abortion in the country or the state even. And they actually voted against the bill. I mean, you had two or three Republicans in the House, looks like Heather Scott, and I believe Paul Shepard, and there was one more who's escaping me at the moment. But they voted against it, saying, you know, they don't want any kind of money going towards abortion providers. When I looked up the records as to how much Planned Parenthood had received from the state in 2019, it was about $285,000, though we don't know what that money actually went to.
And this all came on the heels of some fireworks on the House floor last Friday. Yes. When Heather Scott tried to get her far more far-reaching anti-abortion bill pulled out of a committee or sent to the proper committee for a full hearing. It's been introduced as a personal bill in the House Ways and Means Committee, where personal bills generally are introduced and never heard from again. Representative Scott tried this procedural maneuver, which hardly ever works, to try to get the bill moved along. That brought the House to a virtual standstill for much of Friday morning. Lots of sharp tempers.
You had House Majority Leader Mike Moyle saying and threatening, if we don't get through all of our business today, we are staying and we are coming back on Saturday.
Yeah, it was the legislative equivalent of "Don't make me stop this car."
Right.
I mean, it was really
because I will stop this car and turn it around.
Yeah, it was a very tense. It was a very tense procedure on the House floor Friday morning, but I think it underscores what Jimmy's just talking about. There is a split within the Republican Party about how far do you want to go legislatively on abortion.
Yeah, and you had Representative Brian Zollinger say, "Look, I would love to outlaw abortion. That would be great. I would love to vote on a bill for that, but this gets us closer to making it harder for people to provide abortion services in Idaho."
So where are we with that bill right now then, Jimmy?
So it passed the bill. The bill passed the House 52-17 earlier this week, and state senators are going to take up the issue next in committee.
Before we head into a break, Rebecca, I want to talk about what's going on over at the Idaho Statesman. And some of the so the journalists there are taking steps to unionize, correct?
Yes. So all of the journalists in the newsroom who would be eligible to be unionized apparently unanimously agreed, we want to be a union. So they notify the publisher and McClatchy officials, because the Statesman is owned by McClatchy, of their intent. They asked for voluntary recognition. When that didn't sort of come like back immediately, they went ahead and they went to the National Labor Relations Board, which is the federal entity that sort of oversees union negotiations and things, and said, we want to have an election. So the process now is, they can have an election and then they can agree to be basically a union, and then they can negotiate as a block with the company. Now, this is a somewhat complicated time for McClatchy anyway, because McClatchy has recently declared bankruptcy. And so now there is a panel of creditors that are sort of bringing this bankruptcy process through the courts, right? Trying to decide who gets what as they figure out how to settle all of these debts. The biggest one is a hedge fund. So that would be basically the majority owner, I think, if under the McClatchy's sort of restructuring or bankruptcy plan. But, you know, there are several other McClatchy papers that are unionized. And that guild, that union, also has a seat on the board in bankruptcy court. So this is kind of a complicated process to figure out. McClatchy hasn't voluntarily recognized other unions in some of the other papers, but they still unionized. So we'll see what happens. But it's part of a national trend. I mean, more and more newsrooms are unionizing.
Right. And is this partly, do you think, because of what's going on with McClatchy that the journalists were like, you know what, we need to take this next step?
I think it's a local example of a industry-wide issue, right, in that newspapers are seeing declining profits. Most newsrooms have had major layoffs periodically in recent years. They have declining revenues. The Statesman itself has had a lot of layoffs. They've had a lot of furloughs. And journalists want to keep their jobs, but they're also concerned about the quality of work they're able to do and the resources that they're given to be able to do that quality work. You know, people get into this profession because it's fun, but it's also stressful. It's kind of a right. calling, right? But people get in it because they believe in the power of the press.
Rebecca, I want to talk about what's going on with the execution drug lawsuit here in the state of Idaho, and also some news that's really just developing today.
Right. So let's start with the slightly older news, right, which happened earlier this week. we've talked about it here before. University of Idaho professor Aliza Cover sued the Department of Corrections because she wanted access under the Public Records Act to execution-related documents, particularly documents that deal with the state's lethal injection protocols and their methods and where they're getting those drugs, right? Those drugs have become increasingly hard to get because major drug suppliers now, pharmaceutical companies, will not sell them to prisons. They're not meant to be used for executions. They're meant to be used in surgeries and other things for legitimate, like, medical health mm-hmm. processes, not executions. So she won at the state court level almost everything. There were a few things that the judge said could still be withheld under the Public Records Act, but most of it had to be turned over. Department of Corrections appealed to the Idaho Supreme Court. That case is going to be heard this year. Earlier this week, several news and legal organizations, including the American Bar Association, the Idaho Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Idaho Press Club, which the Associated Press, my company, signed on to, along with a lot of other news organizations, filed what's called a friend of the court brief, basically saying we're in support of the claim that these documents should be released under the Idaho Public Records Act because you can't effectively monitor or serve as a watchdog for government agencies if you don't know what they're doing. The public can't effectively make up their mind how they feel about executions if they don't know how they are carried out. So that's the old news. The new news, though, and it's worth a read. So Idaho Press, right. Idaho Press, idahopress.com, Tommy Simmons had a story today. This is not my story. I was just reading it. that there's a new lawsuit filed by the Federal Defenders of Idaho. So that's those are like the public defenders that represent death row inmates and other people. Mm-hmm.
Can we just read this lead?
Go right. ahead. Seriously, Jimmy, because it is. We thought the Lori Vailo case was unbelievable. This is shocking.
I'm waiting to see who plays Josh Towalt in this movie that will eventually be made, I hope. So the lead in Tommy Simmons' story says, in May 2012, before he was appointed director of the Idaho Department of Correction, Josh Towalt bought lethal injection drugs with a suitcase full of cash in a Walmart parking lot, new court documents allege. The drugs were later used in the execution of an Idaho prison inmate.
And it goes on to say,
oh, I mean, that he took more than $10,000 in cash on a chartered plane to Tacoma with Kevin Kempf, the then chief of the department's division of operations, according to court documents. And this, it just goes on from there.
So, and part of those details were actually revealed because of the lawsuit from the U of I professor, and that there was this documentation of this weird cash purchase, and I think it was like $16,000 or something was taken out.
I think in the story, Tommy says in the court documents it was $10,000 in cash, correct? More than that.
Yeah.
Right.
So
there was a good. I mean, I think everybody knew they were using that cash to buy the lethal injection drugs, right? That's what that was for, and that they were doing something sort of outside the normal procurement method.
Like a Walmart
contractually and, you know, for normal meds, right? This lawsuit says that they went to a Walmart in Tacoma, Washington.
You can buy anything at Walmart.
And did a deal in the parking lot.
It's just like a scene out of Miami Vice, right? Where you just like slam a suitcase full of cash on the hood of a Lincoln Town Car and you're like, show me the goods, right? But it just underscores how difficult it was to get these execution drugs even back in 2012, right? There was a story, you know, when I was in Delaware that the Associated Press did where the economic development director at the time for the state, he used to run a chain of pharmacies that Walgreens eventually brought up. But since he was in the pharmaceutical industry for so long, he actually helped the state at the time secure new execution drugs through his former industry contacts as well.
So this will, as you said, Rebecca, be taken up by the Idaho Supreme Court this year.
Well, this lawsuit, the lawsuit from the
U of I professor.
U of I professor, yes.
Right.
It is scheduled to go before them at some point this year. I don't know if it's been scheduled for an actual oral arguments yet or not, but it's going to come up this year.
But this is honestly, as you said, worth a read. Go to idahopress.com and look for that. Kevin, this is not as sexy at all. However, this actually probably affects many more people, in all honesty. And this is the upcoming election on Tuesday. And even though we've had presidential candidates dropping like flies, this could really affect school districts.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for letting me follow up
Absolutely.
On Tommy Simmons' story with a segment on school levies. Thank you for setting me up for failure here. But
it really does affect more people.
It is. It's a fairly big election around the state. You have 41 school districts across Idaho are going to their voters with levies, supplemental levies or plant facilities levies. And this is a big deal for school districts. And this is a key election for school districts. We've talked about this before about moves to try to get rid of these March and August school elections because there's a concern that the voter turnout isn't very high. I think the turnout will be higher this time around simply because we've got the presidential primaries going on at the same time. But, you know, 41 districts and some fairly large districts right here in the Treasure Valley. Nampa is going back to the voters seeking a levy. This is, you know, 4 months after they tried to get a levy passed and it failed by 11 votes. So they're taking another run at it. Caldwell, Middleton, Valley View, and a lot of smaller districts all over the state. So while most other reporters will be watching the presidential primary results, we'll be keeping an eye on the school levies because it's about $175 million worth of levies across the state.
And we should know that the K-12 budget was set in the state house?
Yes. JFAC set the K-12 budgets, sent them all seven bills, will now head to the House and the Senate for a vote. There was some fireworks, though, because the Budget Committee took quite a bit of money and quite a bit of authority away from State Superintendent Sherry Ibarra. The Budget Committee wants to take the IT functions and the data management functions away from Sherry Ibarra's State Department of Education, move it under the umbrella of the State Board of Education. We're talking about 18 positions that would move. We're talking about almost $3 million of money. I mean, you don't see this very often, where the Budget Committee actively takes money away from an agency, in this case, a constitutional officer, a statewide elected official, and puts it in another agency. I mean, it's pretty rare.
Did they give any reasoning as to why?
The supporters of the move say that they want to have all of this data under one roof. And the State Board already collects data on the higher education institutions, so this would put the State Board in charge of the data for K-12. Sponsors, supporters of the move say that there have been data management and data access issues with the State Department of Education for a while. Ibarra was fairly well blindsided. So, no, this is not as sexy as buying lethal injection drugs in a Walmart parking lot. But this is good politics. This is a really interesting development that broke on Tuesday. Now we'll see what happens with that spending bill as it goes to the House and the Senate and to the governor.
I tell you, it's been a crazy week. And at least it's the end of it. Thank you all so much for coming in. Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. I appreciate your time. And I tell you, we learn something every single Friday. This is Idaho. It's always something. This is Idaho Matters.